Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of No Killing Goblins. I'm here with Dragonus.
Hey, everybody, this is Dragonus.
And I'm Weird Ass Oshi. Full disclosure, we're doing a little bit of a re-record because I fucked up and deleted some files, and we kind of had to backtrack here.
Time is strange and meaningless anyways, so if we say something that sounds weird in episodes after this one and the next one, because it sounds like we're referring back to something we already said, just ignore us.
We're pulling a Pirate Abba and retconning stuff, as everyone says Pirate does.
I mean, Pirate is rewriting the whole first volume, so, like, I guess some retcons do happen, although that's definitely a little bit more involved than, oops, we accidentally a whole two episodes and have to re-record them now. Still, that's life. How has life been?
The life has been weird, because the worst part of this whole situation has been that I feared this exact same thing happening, and do you know why I deleted everything? So I could make more room for CK3.
God, it was poor timing too, but we're working on getting ourselves organized. As we've said before, we are definitely new at all of this, and this is just yet another learning curve. Strangeness.
This is exactly what I was afraid of would happen when I stopped having time to organize the files. That we would lose track of things, and then I would know what needed to be uploaded, and then something would get deleted.
Yeah, and I had actually just organized everything, too, and I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, I guess, like, you know what? Let's not go into it. It's just, you know, one of those things that happens. But you guys get to skip out on listening to me spend, I think, a good 10 minutes talking about the Tactics Ogre remake, so...
Well, we could talk about the OGL stuff instead.
If we start talking about the OGL stuff, I don't know if I'll be able to stop. I have been on every server, on every forum, everywhere that I can, arguing about this stuff, because fuck Wizards of the Coast. But as of us recording this, they have just finally released their statement, like, 2 days ago. I'd just like to say one thing about the OGL, if I can, Oshi.
Well, hang on. Succinctly, for those who aren't aware of what the OGL is, it is a base document that gives a license. Okay, one, we should go step back from that.
Yeah, I think I can do a pretty good job explaining it pretty quickly if you let me take a shot at it.
Oh, yeah, please do.
The core rules of Dungeons & Dragons are licensable through something called the Open Gaming License. I'm not going to get into the laws involving copywriting basic mechanics. That's just way beyond the scope of me saying this. Please, nobody comment on that. I'll mock you. But this makes it so that you can use those rules to make and design your own adventures, your own games, your own game systems, all within that same D20 ecosystem. This has been in place, free, perpetual, all that other good stuff for about 2 decades now. And recently, with nerd culture sort of blowing up and becoming the zeitgeist, and Dungeons & Dragons just being the correct name and the correct brand at the time has been making money hand over fist, the whole market has blown up and expanded, and most of it's gone into their pockets. They decided that wasn't enough and tried to set the OGL on fire by revoking it, despite the fact that it was designed not to be revocable, charging people royalty fees, claiming control and perpetual license over everything that you create, that you publish under the OGL. They wanted publisher rights to be able to actually make decisions on what content was or was not acceptable for you to make. There was a whole bunch of crazy stuff.
There was a lot of stuff, but the core of it was Wizards of the Coast wanted more money, and they wanted more control over their copyright, their license, and they wanted everybody to use the platform that they recently bought, which is called D&D Beyond, which is like a virtual tabletop sort of thing.
Their business plan was to drive everyone else in the D20 ecosystem out, make them all shut down or be forced to buy in under this very bad deal, and then use an expansion of the DM's Guild, which is already a very bad deal I'm not going to go into, roll that in with D&D Beyond, and create their own little closed walled garden. Anyways, it didn't work out. They have been getting screamed at for weeks. The absolute cowards were supposed to release something on Wednesday. that they skipped out on. And then on Thursday, they at the last minute bailed because more leaks came out and more D&D Beyond subscriptions got canceled. Friday, they finally put out a very quiet, very little like, oopsie, we're so sorry, ooh-woo, small company, mistakes happen. Listen, this is just the one thing that I want to say about this, Oshin. Drafts don't come with attached contracts. If anybody tells you this was a draft, they're a liar. If anybody tells you that this was not meant to be the final version, laugh at them.
The reason I consider this a fairly big deal is tabletop gaming has been such a giant part of the pandemic and pre-pandemic. It was blowing up, people were enjoying it, people getting back into things. And part of that was D&D. We have stuff like Critical Role, we have like, what's the other one? Dimension 20 and other shows and YouTubers.
Stranger Things.
And Stranger Things that were just, they brought Dungeons and Dragons back, and it's like a cyclical thing, right? Every 15 years, Dungeons and Dragons gets to come back. And instead of paying attention to all of this and taking advantage of it and expanding the company in the right way, they went for the ham-fisted strategy, and it just did what I actually am kind of excited to see, is that by pushing things the way they have, they've made it so there is a financial incentive for all of those third-party creators and all those people to get together and be like, okay, we don't want to fuck with D&D anymore. So what we're going to do is we're going to come together and make our own documents and our own stuff and make it free for everyone and very Creative Commons style, open license.
Yeah, a Kobold Press announced their intention to create a new basic D20 SRD system that everybody could use that will obviously be compatible with 5e, and because it's not in the OGL, they can advertise it as such, but that's its own whole separate issue. Paizo has announced they'll defend 1.0a OGL in the court, and also are saying they're going to make their own Open Commons license. It's going to be ORC is the acronym. It's great. The Critical Role people subtly put a knife into their back because in the middle of their thing they mention, oh yeah, and this is why we made our own production company. Like, the only way this could get worse for them is in the fourth season of Stranger Things, the kids all sit down and start playing Pathfinder.
That could happen, but I was going to mention also in the addendum to that, Paizo's thing. Paizo was is the third party creator of Pathfinder, which is another setting, and it was made after D&D 3.5 was being changed over to 4.0, and the people didn't like it. So one of the original owners of Wizards of the Coast got together with some people and made the company.
Well, no. So way before the 3.5 thing, Paizo had been created and spun off as its own company by a few people who were high up in Wizards of the Coast that got a whole bunch of money from when Hasbro bought it out.
Right.
They started Paizo explicitly as part of this new OGL plan because they were going to be publishing the Dungeon and the Dragon magazines. They're two very famous, very important magazines that are dead now as a result of this entire shenanigan shit show in fourth edition. They were also publishing, adventures and so on. Well, Wizards of the Coast, when they were trying to figure out how to shut everything down in fourth edition, cut them out of the loop. They wouldn't tell them anything that was going on, but they were yanking the licenses for Dungeon and Dragon. The whole thing was a shit show. They tried to slip a poison pill in, saying if you published anything in fourth edition, you couldn't go back to the OGL with it. That eventually didn't go through. It was a whole fucking
The point being, each time that a company tries to push D&D into a more monetizable model, which is usually worse because the monetization model is already there, they just don't know how to translate it well, and they do try really dumb ways to do it. Because I'm trying to put a business point to this, and there's a reason why I promise, as usual, long-winded argument, and then it'll all come together at the end. So, Wizards isn't trying to do anything. It's Hasbro that's trying to make money off of Wizards. But the tabletop gaming system, not even the organism that's developed around tabletop gaming, is all about all of these third-party gaming systems and all these small creators. And then a few of them get to be really successful, and what they will do is partner with bigger companies, and then those bigger companies will sell those games to the wider market and make a profit, right? That's just generally how it worked out. And because of that, there's this creator economy that exists within the tabletop gaming network. Everybody makes money some way off that creator economy for their day-to-day expenses, their livelihoods, right? And Wizards has been weird about how they deal with the creator economy, but in general, they've left them alone because it benefited Wizards. And every time they try to mess with that economy and mess with that system, they end up in a worse situation, rubber band backwards, backtrack to where they were, and then they end up depending on that same system to come back. Because if you think about it, fourth edition may have been a disaster, but fifth edition was done by using the creator economy to create something like each time it's something simpler.
Fifth edition didn't succeed for any reason that had to do with Wizards of the Coast.
Nope.
We exist at a point in time where nerd culture has sort of overtaken. You got the Marvel movies, like people are getting pulled into the nerd sphere and the market expanded, but they're not going to get that huge market expansion a second time. Like if they don't find a way to fix this fuck up, they're looking at, I think, long-term permanent problems. Short-term, they may even make money off of this. But that gets fuzzy and weird and annoys the shit out of me because they have under-monetized the actual intellectual property of Dungeons and Dragons for so long. They don't make books anymore, Oshi. They used to have so many books that would come out, and they have all of this backlog of excellent stories to make TV shows, to make movies. And we're finally getting our first Dungeon and Dragon movie that isn't a direct-to-DVD shit show in the year of our goddamn 2022?
I understand that feeling, but to bring it back to what I was going to connect it to the Wandering Inn, creations can go far beyond what the creator meant it to be. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, how a creation can go far beyond what it is meant to be.
Okay, you realize I'm now probably going to have to make numerous jokes involving Torin being the manifestation of the OGL here to stab his creators in the back, right?
Sure. But let's start at the beginning. In Volume 3, Torin is going through a sort of upgrade phase, I guess, from minor nuisance to major catastrophe.
Catastrophe is about right.
Yeah, so he's like at the start of the volume, I think, is when he abandons Aaron.
Yeah, he abandoned Aaron at the end of the last volume, and his part in this volume isn't terribly big. The story of Torin is actually kind of a sad one. You know, he murders some people on the road. He grows into that feeling of that endorphin rush of pulling the wings off of those metaphorical screaming people, I mean flies. He makes his way into the big, terrible fuck fest that was Ethelm and the goblins and Ilawis and the other goblins and
Hang on. Here's my thing right there. That first act where he kills people on the road, it's like Torn is all id. He has no ego. Torn is only un is like a ch it's very much a 2-year-old who does not have a sense of anything outside of self and parent, right? Parent is part of self. And from a psychology perspective, I'm sure there's like a complex. If you're a psychologist out there, please comment. But for me, it was essentially you have this 2-year-old who has no genuine understanding of the world and is learning the world through emotions. So this feel good, this feel bad. Murder feel good because life goes out and I get more death magic, so I feel good. So this must be good. Aaron annoying and contradictory, so she bad, so I leave. There's no real logic to any of it. There's no reasoning. There's no introspection. There's only good, bad. And that's all that Torin is. And that leads Torin to some of the most monstrous acts you could possibly imagine a being doing. Well, no, maybe not the most monstrous, but at least.
He aims for the greatest hits.
Yeah. And that is the direct consequence of what Torin is, not who Torin is.
It also, something that I think needs to be mentioned is the way that the system itself is, in its amoral way, reinforcing him because anything you do, it gives you levels. When he does these terrible things, it gives him levels. And Torin, because he's in such a strange place, he has commented in his internal monologue before, he can actually feel the difference in just his movement between levels because, he gets better every time. And if that's not a great way to turbocharge bad behavior,
Yep, I guess one of the weird things about the system itself is it's inherently like
amoral.
it's that thing where in order for you to even have some conception of the world as having principles, having definable rules, ethical things, standards, scruples, whatever you want, all these things that make us able to exist as a society don't exist for the system. System impartially just looks at have they completed a task that qualifies for a level? Have they done something that challenges them? Murdering 60 people is a challenge, right? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it qualifiable? Is the context good? All these things don't matter. Murdering 60 people qualifies you for this much experience. You get this much. It is not a machine, and oh God. We could have a whole talk about the ethics of AI and the source of who the hell gets to define all of the systems, like monikers and how it determines things, but we're moving on from that. I'm sure Pirate Abba will one day depth go deeply into it, but I hope so, because it'll be great. But that's where Torin is. That's where the system is. The system is rewarding. They're both similar in that sense. Neither have that conceptual system. So the system thinks that 60 people dying rewards this much experience and it's done its job, and that's good. Torin thinks killing 60 people feels good, so it's done its job, and then a feedback loop into each other, just like you were saying, Dragnus.
Yeah, and it would obviously already still be a problem because of the reasons you mentioned, right? Torin is basically a fully formed, fully functioning adult who has no context and this childlike thing, and he has that power to reach out and get all of the immediate gratification of squeezing some poor animal to death and then murdering a moose and then upgrading to people. It's just something that I think we'll be talking about more across the series, especially later on in a specific incident, is the way that I feel that the system's rewarding of bad behavior can skew even what happens with people who have good intentions. And when you have somebody who doesn't have great intentions, or God really has no intentions in Torrin's case, it gets ugly.
Yeah. Well, I guess we should talk a little bit about Torin in context of what happens in Estel, because the majority of Torin's presence is in, like, his story arc is he leaves Eren, he wanders, he finds an undead horde and decides, yeah, I'll become the leader of the undead horde, and becomes leader of undead horde, and then leads it to rampage because rampaging is cool. And there's this, in my head, it was like a Rugrats episode.
A little. I get what you're saying. Yeah, it's like a Rugrats episode, only every now and then it cuts from the Rugrats perspective to the horrible genocide they're trying to commit because they're living in a fantasy land.
Yeah. Oh my God, I forgot about Defunct Land. That's why I was remembering the Rugrats. For those who do not, who are too young to know what Rugrats is, it is a show on a television network called Nickelodeon, if you know what Nickelodeon is, from the 90s. It was a cartoon show. It was about little babies and they could talk, and we got to enjoy their adventures as they explored the world and try to come up with reasonings about why things were the way they were and what they did. And it had some really funny episodes and talks and variations. And it reminded me of that because that's what Torrin's doing. He's just being a child in his parlance. Also, I disagree with you in that he's fully functional, fully adult. He has the body of a monster and the mental focus, like
Yeah, physically is what I meant there, right? Because, like, kids develop and their bodies are as mushy as their brains are, and, you know.
And that's a good thing, because imagine a fully functional 2-year-old who could smack.
Yeah, that's Torin.
Yeah.
And, God, in Esselm, it's fascinating to me with Torin. It almost, like, makes me think of, if in a very different isekai, the story of Torin, the evil overlord, as he, you know, levels up and gathers his army together and has his whole progression fantasy, only then he loses and gets his ass kicked.
Yeah. Esthelm happens. Torin arrives. The goblins fight him. The silver swords fight him. Esthelm's people fight him. The flower girl does what she does. And Torin is. I think that was the first time he was. He's always been the guy who. Like the kid who constantly gets beaten the shit out of until they finally have some modicum of power and they go power crazy and start beating everybody else up because that's all they know. And then he's defeated and banished. And then just as he's about to like get angry and come back and do his thing all over again, Eren, who is sitting in an inn in the city of Selim, being told by Pisces that Pisces and the Horns all about how Torin has caused these horrible things. And Eren decides to cut Torin off.
Yep, pulls the plug. Although, are we at that point yet? I thought there was still more stuff to talk about in Nestle.
No, I know. I'm just talking about like the overall arc of what happens. I'm happy to talk more about Estelle in context, but I wanted to go through the arc because it's almost like he's allowed to get to a certain point and then he's killed and he's reframed from lost child Frankenstein monster to just Frankenstein monster. And the choice that Eren makes at the end. Eren is directly responsible, whether she meant to be or not, for what Torin becomes. And then her choice is to cut him off, to kill him.
Yeah, she was a terribly negligent parent. And I put part of this on Pisces as well, because
Absolutely.
Pisces knew that the Torin was a science experiment that could have well worked, but he just didn't warn anyone about it. And Eren, to her credit, is incredibly capable of finding the humanity in just about anyone. I don't know why she couldn't see it in Torin. The signs were pretty clearly there. Even Lyonette could see it, mostly because Torin just took so much joy in tormenting the poor girl.
And that was the core of it. Like, his creators, his parents, rejected him. And they did it because they just didn't know how to deal with him. It's both tragic and horrific. I do not excuse, condone, or accept anything Torin did. I always thought of Torin as, like, monstrous in a little way, and that this was a really bad idea. But this kind of cemented the wandering inn for me in volume 3 was like Torin is a monster, will always be a monster, is condemned to be a monster, and Eren and Pisces cutting him off could confirm that for me.
Like I said, it's Torin's story is a very sad story. But you never know, Oshi. After he gets cut off, he may wander into some fairy fountain and come out with a real body and then go romance Eren, like you thought initially.
Look, it was a legitimate fucking theory. It happened in so many damn manga. Like, don't you fucking dare. Don't you fucking dare to.
I'm just saying, you know, it's always possible.
In any case, that's what I really want to just chat about, that juxtaposition of innocence, violence, the failures of parenthood. It's all in there. Whether or not Pirate meant it to be, whether or not it achieved those goals at the highest levels is debatable. There's plenty of parts where Pirate's prose kind of went above, or sorry, below what their target was. And I don't necessarily love how Torin's internal monologue sometimes gives different impressions than it should. Like, there's things to quibble about, but in general, I think it was a pretty good success as a storyline.
Yeah.
But you want to talk about Estelle.
Oh, well, it's interesting because even in like Esthelm, when Torin is, you know, basically trying to build an undead horde one building block at a time. And it's fascinating that he even can do that, that he can just naturally reach out, take control of nearby undead, and pick up the, I think it was a leader class.
Yeah, undead horde leader? I don't know.
Well, he had, I think, skeleton knight and then leader. Anyways, he had classes that, just one day were going to combine, and it was going to be like evil overlord, skeleton commander, general. Like, it was going pretty fucking wild and ham. But even then, there was still a certain curiousness to what he was doing. Because when he came across War Crime in Progress and he scares the guy off and murders him, and then the girl's just standing there, like, well, hold on, do I murder this girl too? I just murdered this guy, and this is really fun. I can just keep stabbing him, and as she's running away, I won't bother chasing him. Even when he was being, like, actively at his most evil, he wasn't being terribly malicious about it. It was really a bit disturbing from his point of view.
Okay. Okay. I did enjoy the fact that it was revealed, sort of, that Pisces at least understood some of what he'd done. And we'll talk about soon enough about Wistrom and Pisces' experience in Wistrom. But some part of me is always like, okay, you've met and seen beings who are sapient and non-human and non-humanoid. What the fuck did you think you were doing? It's the fact that Pisces is the classic evil, like, not even evil, just genius who knows, who thinks that they're doing something and they have no genuine understanding of the consequences.
The only way I could think of to even describe Pisces is that the man has, like, all of this genius and ability and power, and he goes and he makes this ultra powerful skeleton, and then he just kind of forgets about it.
I wondered, okay, time to poke at Pyre d'Abba, the writer. I wonder if it's literally because Pyre d'Abba forgot about it.
Maybe. Well, it's just like Pisces gets caught up in a bunch of stuff right after, right? And then he joins the Horns and he heads out, and then all of this craziness with Torin going AWOL happens while Pisces is gone. But you would think that, like, Pisces would have been keeping an eye on Torin and trying to figure out, like, if what he had done had worked. Or actually, I'm still confused how he could, like, successfully have done this spell that made Torin a sentient leveling undead and not even realize he'd done it. Like, it's just ADHD. Like, the man's got to go take some Ritalin or something.
Okay, so on the subject of, like, developing characterization and developing the character, I had this theory that Torin is or was certainly meant for something else, and the pirate might have changed tack. I always got the sense that Torin was supposed to be intricately, like, another piece of pirate's attempt to make, how do I say this? Eren didn't want to be a general, but she'd get a general. She had the Antinium, and she gets Torin as well. So Torin was gonna be, if she was, like, gonna be a traditional isekai manga slash leveling hero, she'd always get generals, right? So she would have gotten the folks from the Antinium, like Kilbekich and Relk and all that stuff, but she would have had her own, like, defender and creator, and that's where I got the whole romance series from. And that would have been Torin.
Maybe.
And it felt like because she was never really a person who had magical potential, because they explicitly said she doesn't on that level, and she didn't have that kind of minion thing, that maybe this was another homage to a possible path she could have taken, and then it developed a little differently. Pirate really did, in the early couple of volumes, I would say 1, 2, 3 or so, have a really evolving sense of how they wanted the story to go. I genuinely believe they know where things are supposed to end and where things are supposed to genuinely begin, but the journey has been a very much an evolution. And I wonder if how much Torin's characterization and character path changed over time. I really, really wish somebody had asked that during the damn AMA last year. I can't because I was helping put the fucking AMA together and it just made me, like...
I mean, but put it on the list for the next AMA or we just, you know, scream at Pirate loudly.
Maybe the answer.
On the subject, though, of more traditional-style protagonists out there in the world, in the Esselm chapters, I feel like it really was Torin who interacted most with the newly introduced Silver Swords, who are fucking hilarious great characters in their own right. Dwarves are always funny, don't at me. And Ilawis, we don't really get to see much of Ilawis early at this point, but I just like the idea of this adventuring team hears there's a problem, rolls in to help, and then doesn't leave when they realize how in over their head they are, because they're there to stick it out and help people. Adventuring has come across as very mercenary in this setting. You don't get a lot of that kind of selflessness.
Okay, that's a fair thing. I mean... adventurers are inherently mercenary. It's nice to call yourself adventurers, but let's be real, the Adventurers Guild is the mercenary guild. It's the monster killer guild. That's it. What I went oh my bot about is I want you to go into the No Killing Goblins Gmail account because we got a really nice email from someone named Stu. I'm not gonna say the rest of it. Whitechapel, I think we're allowed to call him. In any case, they said some nice stuff and had a commentary, and they were on episode 37. Apparently they were listening to a stone. And they said some really nice stuff, and one of the things mentioned was that they... this is something that we should probably talk about next episode, actually. And we'll talk about it next episode. Yeah, definitely. Do you have anything else to say about Torin's, like, arc and adventuring style and who and what he is?
No, I think that about covers it. Mostly, if I had anything else to say, it would just be cursing out Aaron and Pisces some more.
I honestly, the only parallel I'd say is try to remember that goblins are also monsters, and Torin and goblins share some similarities, and seems like Pirate Ava likes to play with the monsters. That's all I got. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time. This will be a couple short episodes, and then we'll be back to our rambling selves in the next couple.
See you next time, everybody. Good night.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins.
Edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter, at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.